Hey, Austin Recovery alumni, I'm Jim, an alcoholic. Amen. It's good to be here with you guys tonight. I have some history with Austin Recovery going way back. I was nailed up to sheetrock in the first building out here when it was called the Inebriate Farm. They let guys live out here. It was men only then. And they let guys stay out here as long as they were sober, going to meetings and had a sponsor. So we had guys living out here a year, year and a half. It was great. They had gardens, animals, and time is our friend in terms of recovery, right? And those guys got to be out here a long time and find recovery. It was really awesome. There's a special place for Austin Recovery in my heart over the years. As I get into my story, you'll understand why. I'm not an alum, only an honorary alum. I didn't go through treatment here, but I've been very involved the last 40 years with Austin Recovery and supporting it. How many guys here and ladies are alumni of Austin Recovery? Wow. Wow. 2 years ago, we couldn't get three people out here to this meeting, you know? That's awesome. Excellent. How many clients? I recognize some of the ladies. I go to a Wednesday morning AA meeting where you guys show up with the children. That was Austin Family years ago. What's it called now? Family House. Family House? Yeah. Bill Wigmore, the ex-director out here, saved that program for this community. So you have God and Bill Wigmore to thank for your recovery. He's an awesome guy. When the funding ran out for it federally, he stepped in and picked it up and made it work. Thank God. Isn't it a great program? Yeah. Aren't many of them around the country like that either, that offer treatment for women and their kids together? There are some, but not many. So you really have a great opportunity. How it was, what happened, and what it's like now. I was an Austinite. I'm a native Austinite. We have any of those here? They're rare. See, there are fewer of those than alumni by far. There aren't many of us that are natives. I grew up in South Austin, went to Travis High School. My dad was an alcoholic. His father was an alcoholic, and we're pretty sure my great-grandfather was an alcoholic based on some of the letters that we read that my great-grandmother had written about him yelling at the kids to find his pipe, and they were afraid to tell him it was in his mouth. Those kinds of stories. Sounds like alcoholism, doesn't it? We're not sure. But anyway, the gene was in our family. And my father died when I was 13. He had a heart attack, his first and only. He was a heavy smoker, heavy drinker, and he only got one heart attack. It took him. And I'll remember all the relatives that came down for the funeral. And one of my aunts, being very well-meaning, told me that I was the man of the house now, and I needed to take care of my mother. Well, I knew where the man of the house kept his Kentucky Tavern, and so when I was 13, I started drinking, and by the time I was in the ninth grade, I was drinking alcoholically, blacking out, starting to drink, never knowing how it was going to end up or where I would end up. By the time I was 19, I'd already had a DWI. Who were the native Austinites again? You know, in the 60s, you had to really piss a cop off to get a DWI. They had so much paperwork associated with it. They hated doing it. They didn't want to put kids in jail. You had to really screw up to get DWI. Well, I got one when I was 19. And when I was 22, I got married. And at 23, I got another DWI. And that DWI, I hired an attorney because I wanted to try to get out of it. He told me to write down everything I had done that day and where I was, how much I'd had to drink, and where I was arrested. And so I wrote all that out for him, dropped by his office. He called me in a couple of days and asked me to come by. And he said, it says here you were on Lamar around 10 o'clock when you were arrested. The police report says you were on South First going 90 in oncoming traffic at 2 a.m. And it was South First and Annie Street, I think. So obviously I had no real recollection of the arrest. Probably saved somebody's life, maybe mine, getting arrested that night. And while I was on probation for that DWI, I had a horrible accident on Slaughter Lane. You remember when Slaughter Lane was a country road?
Yeah.
There used to be a driving range out there, and the driving range served alcohol. So I could go out there Saturday morning and drink, and I took my golf clubs to finesse my wife. You know, no other reason. I didn't hit anything. I just went out there and drank. And I was driving back to the house at noon, and I hit an old couple that were returning from the hospital from his heart attack and totaled both cars, injured him slightly. I wasn't hurt at all. I don't know what it is. We're so relaxed when we're drunk or something, but I just wasn't hurt. And the police came out, wrote up the ticket. The DPS officer that showed up, I had played baseball with in high school. So he didn't give me a DWI. And again, I was on probation for my second one at that time. You know, the reality was that alcohol is but a symptom, right? We've heard that. You guys in treatment heard that yet? Alcohol is but a symptom. I was in so much pain all the time. I never really grieved my father's death. And I was well into my 20s and still holding on to all that grief. My home life as a youngster was stressed, to say the least. There was a lot of abuse going on in an alcoholic home. I'll talk more about that in a little bit. But I was just in a lot of pain, and alcohol was the medicine. I self-medicated, and it worked. It worked really well until about age 27. And at age 27, I'd been off on a four-day bender, and I came home, and my wife had taken my daughter and left no forwarding address and told all of her family that she knew I would call to not tell me where they had gone. And so this called for desperate action. And so in an attempt to manipulate her back into the house, not to stop drinking, not to get help for my alcoholism. I hadn't even admitted I was alcoholic at that point. But in an effort to manage the situation, I called a friend's father I knew had been in AA. And he worked at the Texas Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse. His name was Tom. And Tom came over and visited with me. And he told me how he stayed sober. And the way he stayed sober was if he got stressed out, he'd just take a Valium. And somehow that didn't ring true to me. I didn't think that would work. He said, you may want to try AA. And he said, it works for a lot of people. So he calls AA. They come and pick me up and take me to the 24-hour club on Oltorf Street. Any of you remember where that was? Yeah. It's next to Brock's Cafe, one of my favorite, the Brock Burger. I love that hamburger. And I go over there, and the woman that picked me up was a nurse. She called her and her friends the drunk squad. In the 70s, we didn't have the treatment center opportunities, detoxes, and help that we have available in the Austin area today. There's nothing like that. We had a state hospital and a detox at the state hospital. But if you'd been to the detox twice in a year, you were blacklisted for the third visit. You know, and they're trying to convince us it's a disease. And yet, you know, can you imagine being turned away after your third heart attack? Oh, you already had two. We can't let you in the emergency room for your third heart attack. Sorry. But that's what they were doing then. And so a lot of people showed up at the 24-hour club needing help. A lot of us, people in need. And Arlene was this lady's name, the nurse. And Arlene and her friends would help them. She'd try to get them into detox at the state hospital, get them into programming, whatever. Well, she came and picked me up, brought me to the 24-hour club where I started meeting people. I don't remember much about the first week or so. And again, I was there to get my wife back. And I looked at the steps and I saw, well, yeah, my life's a little unmanageable. I got some DWIs. I've been fired 5 times in the last 2 years. My wife's wanting to divorce me. I may have a little unmanageability going on. Step two, I can't deal with this God stuff. Ain't going to work for me. Anybody having trouble with God? Accepting that there's a God or a higher power? I just resisted the hell out of that. I go to an AA with a guy now. He's an emergency room physician. He was telling me he was working the emergency room one night over in, I think he said Bastrop. It was near Austin, but not in Austin. And they brought a guy in that had had a bad motorcycle accident. He was just torn to pieces. He was scabbed all over, black and blue, and several broken bones in really bad shape, and he was helping him bring the guy back to life, so to speak. They got to talking. The guy said he had been drunk when he had this accident on his motorcycle. My friend started telling him about AA. And he said, yeah, I used to go to AA, but they do that God thing there, and I can't get into God. And my buddy, the doctor's looking at him, said, how's that philosophy working for you? Yeah, he's laying there broken all to pieces. And, you know, it's amazing to me how arrogant I was that somehow I knew there was no God. But that's how I felt. And it may go back to my father dying at age 13. I think maybe more than a disbelief, I had a resentment toward God for the things that had happened in my youth and especially my father's premature death. So I sat in meetings. I showed up every day at the 24-hour club and hung out, but I really had a hard time with this God thing. And there was a fellow there named Lou. He was quite a bit older than me. And Lou liked to chair the Sunday night big book meeting. And Lou was bald as an egg, but he had a toupee. And Lou's toupee was kind of big. I mean, this was the 70s. And it was a big toupee, and he'd spray it. And he'd do this big book meeting, and when he'd get to the word God, his hair would shake. It was sickening to me. It was like evangelicals on television. I just couldn't handle it. I'd get up and go to the backyard of the 24-hour club and play dominoes or sit in the swing or something. I could not finish those God meetings. And I'm sure I'm exaggerating, but at the time, that's what it seemed like. Just really struggling with the whole God thing. But over time, as I kept coming back to meetings, and by the way, my wife came back, and my daughter, they both showed up back at the house. And 8 months later, she told me she wanted a divorce. She just said she wanted to give me time to get some traction. And then she wanted a divorce anyway, though, even though I wasn't drinking. So I drank again. I drank for 24 hours after hearing that. And the next day at work, I got fired. And I went back to the 24-hour club with a new humility and a new interest in finding recovery for myself. Is it the president? No. Is God calling? So that's really what turned the corner for me in terms of wanting what I saw those 8 months at the 24-hour club that other people had. I was so full of shame and guilt. You know, I've learned, I'm in the treatment business and have been for 40 years now. And I've learned over the years from science about this disease in a real scientific nature as well as in a recovery sense. And it's fascinating to me how science has validated everything Bill and Bob and the first hundred in our group wrote in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were right on. And now science is just validating it. One of those things that we've discovered is that the addiction, any addiction, occurs in the midbrain, the caveman brain, which is the survival part of our brain. Run, reproduce, and eat. That's pretty much what the midbrain does. Survival, that's it. I said reproduce. Okay. And so there's babies in there, babies in there. So the midbrain is where addiction resides, and for years scientists thought it was in our frontal cortex, the CEO of our brain, where we hold our values. But it's not, and indeed, when we're in our addiction, we can see in real time with the new imaging techniques that we have that the frontal cortex, our executive, goes dormant when we're in our addiction. That's why we do such dumbass things that we would never do sober, right? We can't access, the values are not there anymore. We can't get to them when we're in addiction. Makes a lot of sense. But I was so full of shame. Shame and guilt. One of my favorite stories on shame and guilt. There was this horrible earthquake. Horrible. Just leveled a whole city. And this alcoholic pulls himself out of the rubble the next morning. Kind of dusts himself off and looks around hungover. And he goes, "Oh my God, how the hell am I going to pay for all this?" You know, and that was my shame and guilt. I just assumed it was my fault. Everything. Just full of it. And so the whole disease concept piece that's in the big book and that we talk about in treatment and we talk about in the rooms of AA, you know, it was real important to me. It helped me get past some of that shame and guilt that I was suffering from. I didn't do really horrible things sober. I just didn't. I was a pretty good guy. But when I was drink, which until I was 27, unfortunately was most of the time, all bets were off. You know, I could do about anything. Acid, speed, burn people, steal, lie, cheat, adultery, everything. Once you introduced mood-altering chemicals into my body, all bets were off. And so I learned a little of that those 8 months before I relapsed. And I think that's why I only drank for 24 hours. It's because I knew there was a better way. I'd been exposed to it. So I come back to the 24-hour club, and I decide, you know, I think I'll get a sponsor this time. There's a good idea, isn't it? So I got this guy named Mike Y. Mike had 5 years, and he was a counselor at MHMR. And he could see through my bullshit and would call me on it routinely. And several times he would say, before I asked him to be my sponsor, just sitting in meetings and such before I relapsed, he'd tell me, you know, Jim, I think you may be too smart to be sober. You're probably way too smart to get sober. You can just outthink yourself constantly. And so I asked Mike to be my sponsor, and one of the things that he did for me was send me out to the state hospital. In the 70s, I think I mentioned, there wasn't much in the way of services. And so we did a lot of service work at the state hospital, in motels and hotels, making 12-step calls. Well, there were some stories. And he sent me out to the state hospital one day to meet this fella named Billy. Billy was 41 years old. He had 3 kids. He lived in a house that was about to be repossessed. He was not employed. And he was in the medical surgical ward at the state hospital, so he was in pretty bad shape physically. And Mike asked me to go up and see him and tell him about my experience with AA. I think I had 5 or 6 months at the time. So I went up to see Billy, walk in the room. Here's this guy laying there, swollen out to here and yellow with ascites. His liver can't handle all the process anymore. It's throwing off all this fluid. He was a pretty sick boy. And remember, he was only 41. And I started to describe to Billy my experience of finding AA and how it was starting to change my life and how grateful I was. And I probably spent 15 minutes talking to Billy. And at the end of that, Billy said, "Jim, thank you for coming up to see me, but when I get out this time, I'm going to drink beer only." And I was kind of pissed off at Mike. You know, "Mike, why would you send me to this guy?" He didn't want to hear about AA. And Mike said, "I didn't send him up there for him. I sent you up there not for him. He sent me up there for me. He wanted me to see where this disease would take me." And I heard that a lot at the 24-hour club that first year or two, that this disease is like an elevator. You know, you can ride it all the way to the basement, or you can get off at the earliest floor and opportunity you can find. And for you guys that are in treatment now, I hope this is your last stop. I hope you don't have to go find treatment again after this. The disease has a symptom of denial that gets worse whether we're drinking or not. And I'm going to talk more about that in a minute. So it continues to progress. Denial continues to get worse, even if we're sober. It's fascinating to me. Still, we haven't figured that one out, but it's the truth. It's absolute science that that's the case. So the worse your life is, the worse your symptoms are, the worse denial can be. And that's, of course, what Billy was experiencing. And again, I'm going to talk more about denial in a little bit in the progression of this disease. But back to my newfound recovery that I found that I wanted for myself, got a sponsor, worked the steps with a sponsor, did a moral inventory. The first guy I went to see to read my four-step to was an old friend of the family that was a priest in the Episcopal Church, Catholic Light. And his name was Alan. So I go in and see Alan, and I start telling him, doing my fifth step, telling him a little about what was in my inventory. And I brought up a story about a guy's gas tank that I filled with sugar. And he looked at me, and he's a friend of the family, right? He has no idea what I've been doing all those years. And he says, "You did that?" And we ended the conversation, and I said, "If he can't handle the sugar in the gas tank story, we're not going to go any further with this, because this is going to start to get ugly in a minute." And so that's where I learned how important it is to really trust the person you do your fifth step with. And I did a couple of them, but with two different people, and both of them, one of them was Mike. I went back to my sponsor and did that with Mike. And another one was a fellow named Bill C., who had been around the 24-hour club for years. And he was just a great mentor to me in a number of ways. And, you know, they listened to my fifth step and were not impressed. You know, they're like, "Oh, you know, we've done that. You know, we've done that." No judgment, just listened. We finished. Mike wanted to stand up, and he took both my hands, and he said, "Let's pray." We finished the fifth step, and we prayed. Well, I'm starting to open up to this whole God thing in new ways. And I had an experience at 2 years sober where I go to the doctor because I'm having trouble breathing, and he looks in my nostril, and I've got a tumor right here, very high in my nostril. And he looked at it, and he said, "We need to get you in surgery right away. I've never seen anything quite like this." So 2 days later, we're in surgery. And it was on a Friday. He comes into recovery, and I said, well, Doc, what do you think? What is it? He said, oh, we won't know until Monday. We sent it off to the lab. I said, don't they have a lab for alcoholics that's faster than that? You know, yeah. You got to wait till Monday. And so I spent the weekend having a new, more meaningful experience with step three. I mean, Friday I went home with visions of my face being amputated and disfigured and, you know, cancer everywhere and all that stuff our heads make up. By Sunday night, I was okay. I was, whatever we found out the next morning at the doctor's office, I was going to be good with. And it, thank God, was benign. But that was quite a third step experience over that weekend. Now, I'd had one before, right after that relapse. I was divorced. I'm living in a little wood frame house on West Annie Street. I rented a bedroom from another AA member over there for $50 a month. You could see the ground through the crack at the wall and the floor. It was a pretty rough place, no air conditioning. But it was all I could afford at the time. And while I was there, I fell to my knees one night. And I said, God, you can have this life. You cannot do any worse than I've done with it. And that's really the awakening that I had and started to be willing to believe there might be a higher power and have faith in it. Have faith that the result, whatever it is the way it's supposed to be. I do my part, leave the rest to God. The result is there. It took a couple of years and I was actually able to start calling it God instead of higher power. Star Wars had just come out in the 70s. There was one guy in our group there that referred to his higher power as the Force. He thought that was cool, I guess. He's still sober today. I just had lunch with him a few weeks ago. He doesn't call it the Force anymore. But there were people, you know, that talked about doorknobs and frogs and all kinds of things for higher power. The main thing is that you have or develop a faith and get out of the way of that faith. Let the results be in the hands of that power, whatever that is. And for me, that's where serenity lies. My ability to get as close to accepting how things really are and as far away as from the way I think they should be is where serenity is for me. So we're at 2 years. Now I've had this tumor. Where's Sam? Sam, there's Sam. We were talking about this before the meeting. So I'm at 2 years. I have this tumor, and I'm still smoking 3.5 packs a day. And I've gotten married. I've been married almost a year at this point. And my wife is a respiratory therapist. And she brings home pictures of black lung and puts them on the refrigerator. Never said, I mean, it's like she never went to Al-Anon. She went to a lot of AA meetings with me, but she never went to Al-Anon. She was a very spiritual person, but somehow she just, you know, by default had this Al-Anon attitude. I came home one day, the house was pristine. She cleaned the whole place up and said, honey, thanks for cleaning up the house. It looks great. Oh, you're welcome. I said, but there's this ashtray over here. It's overflowing. You forgot to empty. She said, no, I didn't. She said, I'm not going to empty that dirty stuff. That's your mess. So that's how she was supportive. She never really henpecked me around smoking at all. She was a non-smoker. But I was to the point where, because of the tumor and because I was in recovery and smoking just didn't fit anymore. I don't know how to explain it. I was ready to try to quit. And I tried and I tried and I tried. We had any smokers in here? Man, it's hard to quit, isn't it? God. Way harder than alcohol for me. Way harder. But I kept quitting. I wouldn't quit quitting. and it finally took. And the way I did it was just cold turkey and the steps, and I got a smoking sponsor. And this guy's name was Terry. He was one of us. He was a recovering alcoholic, but he was also a counselor at a smoking seminar program called Dick Cooper's Smoke No More Seminars. And so I took advantage of that. Terry, be my sponsor. And he said, all right, yeah, we can work together. So I'd call Terry. Terry, I'm going to have a cigarette. I don't give a damn what you say, what you do. I've had it. I got to have a cigarette. I'm going to go smoke one right now. And he said, you mean you're going to take some dried vegetation rolled up in paper, put a flame to the end of that, suck the residue of it down into your lungs, and then you're going to feel better? Oh, thanks, Terry. I'll call you later. You know, that would take care of that craving. Turns out cigarette craving only lasts about a minute. Isn't that crazy? But boy, that minute's intense. Woo! Man, I was 3.5 pack a day. I mean, I do everything like that. You know, a package of Oreos shows up at my house, it lasts one evening. I have this disease of excess. Anyway, so after about 8 months of quitting, starting, it finally took. So now I haven't had a cigarette since I was age 30, and I'm 69 now. So, alcohol damn near destroyed me. Recovery gave me the opportunity to get off of cigarettes. I never would have stopped smoking had I not been able to find recovery. No way. I'm certain of that. The tools that I use to sustain the non-smoking effort came from these rooms. So, including the sponsorship idea. So I'm really grateful for that as well. So now moving along, Austin had a lot of needs in terms of service to the men and women who still suffer from this disease. And I don't know why that's been my calling. God just pointed me in that direction. I think it's because I wasn't any good at anything else. I don't know. I just never had a lot of success doing it. I really wasn't passionate about anything else. And when I got into the world of addiction recovery as a profession or vocation, I was passionate about it. I joined all these civic groups. I became the president of the Austin Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse. I just really got involved. I made a lot of 12-step calls, worked with a lot of people. Ended up in 1984 moving to Kerrville and being the director of La Hacienda Treatment Center over there. So now I'm moving to Kerrville. And with my wife and little boy who's 2 years old, and she's pregnant to have our second, which is our daughter. We moved to Kerrville. I take over La Hacienda. The boss tells me after I start the job, La Hacienda is in trouble. Low census, a lot of bad debt, a lot of business problems. You need to get it fixed or we're going to have to close it. This is after I move everybody over there. And I've been in Austin all my life. The move was not an easy decision. So I was working long days, would come home, and my two-year-old would be going crazy. My wife had morning sickness for 7 months. So she was usually laying on the couch really, really sick. It was a tough period, and I'm going to a new AA group. So I called my old sponsor, Mike, back in Austin. I told you about Mike. I said, Mike, this is never going to work. What's the problem? I said, I'm going to these meetings, and they're just not Austin meetings. You know, they're just, I don't know what the deal is. They're just, and nobody, you know, is doing it right. And he said, oh, really? Are they using the 12 steps? I said, yeah, they're using the 12 steps. And he said, well, do they pray? Yeah, they pray at the end of the meetings. They always pray. How many people did you walk up to and introduce yourself to? None. He said, why don't you give it another try? And 2 weeks later, I had a sponsor over there, and I loved AA over there in the Hill Country's great. But it was just the whole thing about change and how much trouble I have with that. Just didn't want to go through it, I guess. But AA in the Hill Country is awesome. Any of you ever been over to AA over there in the Kerrville area? It's pretty good, huh? Yeah. So we were there from 84 to 93. I was director of La Hacienda Treatment Center. It was a great experience, a lot of fun. I met people all over the state. Most of the people I worked with every day are in recovery. Had two kids now. And I leave La Hacienda in 93 to start my own company. And it's called Heartland Behavioral Health Management Company. I had one business partner, and we're traveling all over the United States, consulting with treatment centers, showing them how to fix the ones that aren't working well. And I have suffered from depression pretty much my whole life. My mother was also very depressed, and so was my brother. I have a half-brother who had a different father who was not alcoholic, and my brother's not alcoholic. But he was very depressed, as was my mother. So I'm struggling with energy and some other issues. I go to this friend of mine who's an addictionologist, physician, tell him about it. And he says, you're depressed. And he puts me on Prozac. And I'd been on Prozac about 3 weeks, and the lights just came on. It was like, wow, this is what it's like to feel alive again. This is great. Had my energy back. My attention span was back. And I'd been on Prozac for about 2 years when the decision occurred to me that my problem my whole life had been depression. The ability to drink like normal men is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. Have you ever read that somewhere in a blue book around here somewhere? I quit going to meetings. It took about 11 months for me to pick up. So I had 19 years. I'm on an airplane coming back from Pennsylvania where I was running a treatment center and started drinking in the airplane. I was in first class. I've traveled so much, I get these free upgrades. And so they just give you booze up there. And my thought before the drink was, you know, I never had a Coors Light. Coors Light wasn't in Austin when I quit drinking. Yeah. Oh, I found out. So 15 months of terror. About 90 days into this relapse, my wife had never seen me drink, by the way, and it scared her to death. You can imagine. All the information we've had about the progression of the disease, how it progresses even when you're not drinking, I was sick as a dog at 90 days. I was so messed up. And prior to picking up, I'm a runner, I'm going to the gym, I'm healthy, I'm playing racquetball, I don't smoke. Still didn't smoke, thank God, when I drank. But at 90 days, I was one sick dude. I go to the Western Trails group in Austin, and Buster was in there. And I hooked up with Buster and said, man, you got to help me be my sponsor. I got to get off of this crap. But every time I'd fly back from the East Coast on those planes, I'd get home drunk. And this went on for about 15 months. And I went to see a friend of mine who's a counselor here in town named Jack Reed. Any of you know Jack? Yeah, I go see Jack. And Jack says, Jim, try this new meeting I've heard about over at Westlake called Desire to Stop. Where's our little moms over here? Desire to Stop on Wednesdays. Yay. So I go to that meeting. First time 20 years ago, March 1st. And there's a fellow that started it named Mac. And Mac left Western Trails and started a meeting over there called Desire to Stop so people could go to it who wanted to talk about whatever their addiction was, alcohol or drugs, and not be shamed about it or discouraged from talking about it in the group. What a novel idea. It's not as big an issue now, but there were years ago, there were still a lot of AA groups where you couldn't bring up drugs. You just couldn't. And Mac was a Vietnam veteran that was very involved with the vets. He suffered from PTSD from Vietnam. He was a helicopter pilot and had been shot a few times. And so he's going to the Vietnam vet group. He's starting this new group. And anybody that walks, he's retired now, retired military. Anybody that walked in that room, he stood ready to help no matter what. He would help you. And there were probably five people there when I started the first day I was there. And typically we'd have 5 to 8 people in that morning meeting at 9 o'clock. It was at 9 then. It became 9:15 as the MOPAC traffic got worse. That's a true story. But it was 9 o'clock then, and there just weren't that many people in there. But how about the diversity of our AA program? I mean, it's great. I think the book says something like, we're a group that would normally not mix, something like that. Isn't that so true? This group, I'm going to it. There's Mac, a Vietnam veteran, 2 lesbians, one guy that's transitioning to be a woman. We had a black guy that attended regularly, and me. It was just such a diverse group, but we shared that common bond of the terror of addiction and wanting to survive it. Out of desperation, we showed up at AA. I don't know anybody that went into AA whistling and happy. We were all pretty desperate. And we held on to each other and supported each other. And I just picked up my 20-year chip on the 1st of March. Yeah. Yeah. And that's God. God. Lou and his hair, God. I've become what I object to. If I sound like a preacher, raise your hand or throw something at me, either one. I don't want to sound like a preacher. But thank God for God, and thank God for second chances. Most people who have double-digit sobriety, the facts are that they don't ever make it back. They may come back for a meeting or two, but typically they end up dying drunk or being institutionalized. So I'm one of the lucky ones. Very, very fortunate. And all that shame and guilt I was talking about. I was referred to a woman, an author on shame, called, her name is Brené Brown. Heard of her? Do you get exposed to that here at Austin Recovery? I don't know. If you don't, you can always pick it up when you leave and you're doing your aftercare and meetings. She writes about shame, and it's some really good stuff. Additionally, after my relapse, I went to 2 years of therapy to deal with the one secret I would not deal with the first time around. There was too much shame associated with it. What was going on in my household as a kid? I just couldn't talk about it. And after the relapse, I decided I better. And I went to therapy for 2 years and processed that, and it set me free. I don't feel the need to change the way I feel every day anymore. You know, changing the way you feel can stay with you even if you're not using, right? You go to meetings to change the way you feel. You go exercise to change the way you feel. You eat a package of Oreos to change the way you feel. Lots of ways to change the way you feel. Hopefully, you're finding healthier ways. But the 2 years of therapy. The book tells us, religious people, professionals, many of them have something to offer. Make use of it. Make use of it. You got to be careful with doctors. Got to be a little careful with doctors. They're still not quite getting it around some of these medications. But other than that, there's a lot of good folks out there in the different counseling professions and such that have helped me. So I'm eternally grateful to them. So now I have three kids. My first child was from my first marriage. She's 47 years old. She has 19 years of recovery. Do y'all know who Chris is? Big Chris that works here?
Yeah.
Okay. Big Chris has been part of our family for 19 years. My daughter and Chris became really good friends, and when Chris's father passed away, my daughter, who's in recovery, went to the funeral, meets Chris's little brother, and they get married. Andrew. Andrew comes out here on Saturdays. You guys know who Andrew is? You know who I'm talking about, right? Yeah. So my daughter's married to Andrew. I think he's got 20 years right at it, about what I have. And so when we have family gatherings, there's a lot of recovery around, and it's so much fun. It's really cool. My son from my second marriage, Adam is 36. He's been going to meetings with me lately. He thinks he might have a problem. And then my youngest is 31, my daughter. She just did the forum. What's it called? It's a weekend workshop to work on yourself. I can't think of the name of it. Doesn't matter. But it's a workshop for self-improvement. Don't think she has a drinking problem, but she's a person that always wants to improve herself and is very talented. Beautiful young girl, has two kids. So Jennifer has three. My youngest daughter has two. I've got five grandkids. And my 18-year-old grandson, Jennifer's oldest, was just accepted into the University of Texas Plan 2, which is a prestigious academic plan over there. But more importantly, he was one of five selected for the jazz guitar program at the University of Texas. This kid can play like you can't believe. He's so talented. And he saved his mother's life. She gets pregnant 19 years ago, comes to me and says, "Dad, I got to tell you, I've started going to NA. I've been on heroin for the last 3 years. And I'm pregnant, and I started going to NA." I said, "Oh, I had no idea." She was an academic whiz going to the University of Texas, had 2 degrees and doing heroin. So the miracles just don't stop coming. But this kid saved my daughter's life. If she hadn't got pregnant with him, I don't know if she'd be alive today. She told me after the fact that she'd been to the ER twice and had to be resuscitated, overdose on heroin. And for those of you that are parents, you know what a kick in the gut that is to hear that. But God is good. And my recovery and my life is amazing, and it's all because the 12 steps in this unbelievable fellowship habilitated me. No rehabilitate. I didn't know how to live till I got here. Once I got in these rooms, you guys taught me how to live successfully. What a difference. Before, no God, lawyers, divorce, sick, fired, financial problems. Recovery, the world is at your feet. It's limitless. Thanks for listening to me. You know what? You guys kept me sober today. I don't know if any of you guys got anything out of it, but I won't use tonight. Thank y'all.